Welcome to the 54th episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with my friend, former podcast co-host, founder of Flatiron Health, as well as Invite Media, now the founder of Curry Bio, Zach Weinberg. We go in a bunch of different directions talking about his history. We've never actually covered the companies he founded and what each of those businesses did, how he thinks about finding product market fit, how he actually found these problems, as well as what he's up to now and why he no longer is willing to come on every single episode with me now that he actually has a business to run. And so we talk about what Curry Bio is up to. And Zach made a commitment to come on again in a few weeks, and we're going to do a market update as well, and sort of his perspectives on what's going on in the venture and private technology landscape. So fun conversation with Zach. I always appreciate him coming on. Before we get into that, just a brief plug to please like, subscribe, share, all that usual stuff. We do this to continue to grow the audience here. And so your support is super appreciated, as well as sharing, promoting, all that good stuff. So thanks everyone for their support. And trust you'll enjoy the conversation now with Zach Weinberg from Curry Bio. Zach Weinberg.
Everyone's a victim. Sorry.
That's good. No, that's a good non sequitur.
Yeah,
that's a good non sequitur into this. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah. Happy to be back. We're in person.
We've never done a proper, I feel like we sort of, you came on and then it became a thing, and then, but we never, I don't know, we never talked about your actual background. It sort of came out at different points in time along the way, but we've, so you're now on your third venture backed endeavor.
Yes. Right? Third one.
You two successful exits to date. First one to Google in 2010. At 23. And second to Roche for $1.9 billion in 2018. You run a VC firm of your own.
Like,
I mean,
not a VC, VC firms.
Sure,
we actually originally were going to
call
it. I
don't identify as a VC. I identify as a podcast.
Right, yeah, exactly. We're just a pool of money. It's a family office structure in the sense that, like, it's all our own money.
Yeah.
So we don't have outside investors in it.
It's just you and Nat.
Me, Nat, Amit Avner, who is an ad tech entrepreneur that I knew from Invite Media Days, who does ad tech, deep tech, security. He's based in Israel. So we do a lot of companies coming out of Israel. And then Flatiron CTO.
Got it.
Gil.
So you have that. You also wiped out an entire asset class.
Yeah, it's been good.
Yeah.
Although Bitcoin's managed to like pull itself.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're coming back on.
Right.
It's actually you actually could probably map your podcast appearances to crypto.
You know, when you think you've killed the bug and it's still like crawling, and you got to just like.
I know. That's and here we are. We got to stomp it back out. And you helped propel this podcast last summer at the. How old are you? 36.
36. Wow. 36.
Big. Career to date. You almost retired. Yeah, but you're keeping at it. Okay, so background, you grew up in New York.
Grew up in the city.
And then went to Penn?
I went to Hunter for high school
on
the Upper East Side, and then I went to Penn for undergrad.
And at Penn, you met your longtime business partner, co-founder Nat, in freshman year?
Freshman year.
What's the story about Elf and you guys meeting?
It's a real story. Yeah, actually, it was
Jacob, who's on our team and worked at Flatiron with you. It like loves the Elf story. He was like, "Yeah, make sure you ask him about
the Elf." Yeah, that's the critical part of the podcast.
Yeah.
No, it's a real story. We met in a writing. We both went to Penn, but we went to Wharton undergrad. And part of the reason you go to Wharton is because you don't want to do like writing.
Yeah. And you get to tell people.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like going to school in Boston. Or Cambridge, I guess.
Cambridge, that's right.
And so you have one writing requirement in Wharton. And, see, I noticed I said Wharton and not Penn. And we took this writing class. It was writing about blockbuster movies. I didn't know Nat at the time, so I hadn't been. It was like second semester freshman year. Anyway, one of the things you have to do in that class is like pick a blockbuster movie and then write about it. It's a very rigorous education here in the Ivy League.
Yeah.
And at one point I said, hey, you know, I'd like to write about Elf. Does anybody else love that movie? And then the person who raised his hand was Nat.
That's so funny.
And that is actually how we met.
So this would have been 2005, I guess, spring of 2005?
Spring of 2005, yeah.
And so then you guys fell in love. And what was the path to starting a company? You started a company in college that
failed.
Before Invite. Yeah, we met, we started talking about ELF, and then somehow that became a little bit of what Nat was doing, which was Nat had been doing web development. He was building websites basically for people. This is in 2005, so there's no Wix, there's no Squarespace. You know, this is a skill set most people just didn't even have. I mean, the idea of like, even at Wharton, most people were there to go to Wall Street or consulting or whatever, and being interested in tech was kind of weird at the time. So he was building websites for people who needed something, you know, something done. And he had done it because he had this snake business. This is another long story.
He had a snake, like a selling snake business?
Yeah, Nat grew up in the South and...
Texas, right?
In Texas and moved around a little bit.
By the way, we don't totally take Texas as the South. I want you to know that as someone that like has family in the South, I think Texas is the
Texas
South.
Yeah. And it was in like Houston.
Texas and Florida are sort of like, those are, you know, South adjacent.
Depending on the audience, it's Houston or it's the Woodlands for
that's
Nat.
That's right. Have you ever seen those maps of like, you know, people's perception of the United States from Europe or whatever?
Yeah. Snake hunting actually is one of those perceptions. Yeah. And so he had done like breeding of rare snake. You kind of like take two snakes and I guess you can create these really interesting colors and people collect them. And there was like a snake farming business or breeding. I don't know what the terminology is.
Yeah.
And so you have to sell them. And he had learned how to do a bunch of web development to sell the snakes. He had started this company.
Sure, you're a Jewish kid from New York that went to Hunter for 12 years. And you meet this snake salesman from Texas. And...
Yeah, like I've never even seen a snake.
Yeah.
Let alone like sold snakes. But we came together for, you know, the internet, I guess, is what brought us together. This is all true, by the way.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
Actually, no one would make this story.
It's too insane. Yeah. And, you know, you do the thing that I think every college, now maybe the college kids are more sophisticated, but at the time, you know, you think about a business based on your own life.
Sure.
Which is like, you have all real problems you have in college, which for us was like ordering food. So we got to talking and the idea of what essentially is like Seamless or Grubhub or DoorDash today, but back in 2005, this is like before the mobile phone. This is before most restaurants even had internet in the restaurant. Like you kind of forget that like internet wasn't a thing most places had. People barely had access to like, you know, desktop computers in the restaurant. So we started what was a company called Eat Now, which ended up failing, but it was a great experience because you learned how to like think about the product and think about sales. I did a lot of the field sales of like signing the restaurants up, but it was old school. Like you had to go to a website, order. We would fax the order. We were using like eFax and other fax. I don't remember if it was eFax at the time, but other faxing services to get the order in. It would fail all the time because like their faxes and the restaurant wouldn't know what to do with it. Just like every logistical problem you could possibly have, we had.
Did Seamless and Grubhub like go through all the, I don't know their time period. Did they go through all that stuff? Like, was this too early as an idea to actually work?
So Grubhub started after. Seamless was around, but it was only New York City.
Yeah,
and it was like
for
finance. Yeah, it was like in office ordering and they were doing a bunch of the logistics on the back end, I think on the phone. And then there was a company called Campus Food at the time, which in a funny outcome, I think ended up getting bought by Seamless at a certain point in time. So this was like the real beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is before this was.
It goes to show like no idea is actually proprietary. It's just like right time and execution on it, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like with phones and, you know, it's just the market wasn't ready for it. Now we should have figured that out if we knew what we were doing, but we didn't. And then, yeah, we started it in effectively like the summer before sophomore year. Worked on it for a bit. Eventually you're like, okay, it's not going to work.
Did you guys raise any money or anything?
No, we had put like a little bit of our own money in, like 10 grand.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. So nothing crazy. And yeah, it ended up failing, went back to school. But we, at that point, had kind of like caught the bug of like this internet thing is pretty cool. And then Nat knew Josh Koppelman because Nat built the first Trump Capital website.
That's fine.
Got to know Josh. And then, you know, that led to like an internship, which led to Invite Media.
Invite Media now powers Google's, what, DSP?
The DSP for Google, yeah.
How did you pick you wanted to be in healthcare?
We were just talking about this before we came on. Like, healthcare is interesting, right?
Yeah.
Like, you experience it as a patient or potential patient. It's really odd why it works in the way it works. And then this is 2010, 2011, so this is, like, Obamacare. It's in the news. people are talking about the public option and all that. And you're just like, I don't understand what any of these things mean.
Yeah.
Right.
Were you thinking, like, back to our point of your original business on the timing side of things, like, shit's going to change within healthcare, right? And was that, like, one of the, I mean, obviously it's super impactful and it drives a large portion of GDP and it impacts people's lives and all that stuff. But, like, was there any threat of that? That, like, hey, this is going to be different than it was before?
Yeah. So, yes, but in a weird way. So basically we said healthcare is really interesting. It's really big. There's no software people in this industry whatsoever. And so we probably have an advantage over the next group because we actually understand how to build technology. We maybe don't understand healthcare yet, but literally nobody in healthcare understands technology.
I know you've said in the past to me that you guys were mediocre against, like, software developer, like competing with Stripe or Slack or whatever, like Figma, you would get killed. But like competing with healthcare people, you would wax them pretty.
Yeah, no, we were pretty honest about what we were, like, good enough at, but not great at. Yeah. And yeah, like, you know, the Figma founders would whoop our ass in, like, software development, but they definitely didn't want to spend their time in healthcare.
Yeah.
So we're like, cool, like, white space. And then as we got in, the big thing we noticed was changing in healthcare was the electronic health record adoption curve. Like, you were at the, you could see how the EHR, electronic health record system, was new and, like, just getting to liquidity in the sense that, like, enough people had them because it was effectively required, but that was not true, like, a few years ago. That was it, by the way. It was like, oh, there's something interesting
in here. This is being digitized. This is going to be a slight aside on an industry thread, but that Obamacare sort of mandated, right, that you digitize the EHR.
Yeah, there was a carrot and then a stick.
A carrot and a stick to do that. Has that been a net, like, how that actually came to be, right? Now we actually have EHRs. We've also empowered Epic, which I don't know if people within healthcare obviously know it inside and out. I don't know if the general public's, like, totally aware of Epic doing, whatever, $3-5 billion in revenue a year, worth $50-100 billion.
Oh, I assume no one knows. Unless you, like, think about it from a patient portal perspective, most people would not.
And so it's a monopoly with Cerner, or duopoly with those
duopoly,
two businesses.
Yeah.
And it's very customized software within these health systems. And it's in some ways good and in some ways bad in terms of, like, what they've, has that been a net good for society, like, how all that came to be in the digitization of the EHR, by how it came, like, how it actually occurred and Epic's power within the industry and all that stuff?
So, look, in all these things, there's pros and cons. I think net, you know, we had no ability to understand what was going on inside the walls of a doctor's office or a hospital in any sort of streamlined way prior to electronic health records.
Yeah.
Right. So we were...
I think EHRs are a great thing, but I guess my question is, the normal curve of adoption that would have happened in society, right, without this government intervention that kind of disrupted.
Right, like, why did you need the heavy hand?
Yeah,
well, here's
because then it all happened at once, right? And Epic was there, and they did it, right? And now they have this monopolistic threat power over the industry versus competition just sort of playing out naturally rather than at that one moment.
This is the part that I think we always forget, or people tend to forget in healthcare, which is that it's not just that we think Epic and Cerner have monopolies, and they're like pseudo-monopoly, and we can discuss what monopoly means in that context, but the hospitals have monopolies too. And they're nonprofits, and they don't really face a ton of competition because healthcare is really like a regional product, right? Like, wherever you live, I mean, New York City is a weird one, but in most places, you're not going more than 30 miles to see a doctor.
Yeah.
It's annoying.
Yeah.
So when you think about competition in healthcare, you say, oh, look at all these different health systems and there's no one big player. It's like, yeah, but healthcare is not a national type of choice for most people, right? Like, your choice is basically however far you can get to in like 20 minutes. And so I think the reason the government intervention at the time was necessary is because the hospitals and doctor's offices wouldn't have done it themselves because they're not competing with each other. It's this, like, fake competition. Like, yeah, they kind of compete for, like, certain ancillary services that, you know, are high margin. But in reality, in any market, what are there, like, two local hospitals? So there's no, these aren't, like, enterprise businesses that are trying to, like, grow and make money and be profitable, and they're competing against 900
players. It's not like restaurants, which also have local constraints, but there's infinite choice of, like, restaurants, right? And so the digital adoption of getting internet in the restaurant was going to happen from a customer experience.
Yeah, because the restaurant down the road is doing
it.
And then you're like, well, shit, I'm going to lose all my customers. You have literally, like, competition on your block.
Yeah. And I don't know how many restaurants there are in New York, but let's say 20,000, maybe?
It's one of the most competitive industries in the world.
But health systems, there's 8 in New York?
And that's one of the more competitive markets. New York City is one of the more competitive markets in the U.S. So I think the point was these hospitals and doctor's offices were not going to do this organically in any reasonable time frame.
Yeah.
And part of that also is that, and then we can get into like healthcare as a structure, but their customer, first of all, always a question of like, who's really the customer here? Because the patient isn't the one paying. The patient doesn't see the technology. The patients also don't really choose based on level of service. It's mostly reputation. And so like, and access and ease of access. And so does the EHR really help in any of those areas? Also, part of the value of EHR, of an EHR, is looking across populations, but individual doctors don't care as much about that. There's just like all these weird incentive structures that would lead you to believe that the adoption rate of an EHR on its own would have been really slow.
Yeah.
So I think in the sense that we got that part right, there are a bunch of things I think we got wrong in terms of like, all right, if we're going to basically crown a few companies as like government regulated monopolies because we're requiring an EHR, we're also requiring the EHRs to have a certain set of utility, like of features, right? It's basically like, imagine the government said, anytime a website needs to be built, it needs to have these 6 things, and these 6 things are actually really hard to build. And so it kind of crowns the players who are there, the winners, because good luck, competing when the regulatory requirements are really high. And that's actually what happened, right? The government said we need meaningful use was the term, right? We had a set of requirements that must be there. And basically what you saw were the players who were around at the time were, they already had teams and they had engineers. And so, you saw the market shrink in terms of the number of competitors, which I think is fine if you also mandate interoperability and like data access, which they hadn't and didn't actually until very, very, this is changing like right now, ironically, 10 years after we started in this industry.
Is the FHIR protocol and some of that stuff?
There are protocols, and then there's like the mandate to use them.
Yeah.
And the latter is now kicking into gear. But there was this window in time, and ironically, Flatiron took advantage of this, where the data was there and the usage of the systems was there, but the interoperability and the ability to get data out was not mandated. And so you had to know what you were doing to figure out how to get access to these systems, how to get information out. You were selling, right? It wasn't like a requirement to push and pull data between different tools. And so we were able to kind of find a wedge without going too deep in that market of getting access to electronic health record data in oncology that classically was just not available.
So you want to go into healthcare. You know these big trends are happening. EHRs are being adopted. And have you left Google at this point?
We left... Yeah, I mean, yes, effectively.
And you're kind of pitching Google Ventures. I heard you kept coming to them with like terrible ideas, and they would be like, no. Like, any funny ones along the way that you remember?
Oh, there were some shit ones. I don't remember all the details. We knew in the last 6 months of our time there we were leaving, so we started talking to GV about what we wanted to do. The story that Krishna tells, the partner at GV, is we showed up, they said, what's your next ad tech idea? We were like, we don't want to do ad tech anymore. They laughed. We said, we want to do healthcare. They laughed again. They made a bunch of because like everybody does this. All the tech entrepreneurs like, I want to do something meaningful. And then now it's different. But back in the day, you would like look at healthcare and then go, nah.
Yeah.
Like, nah, it's just like annoying as shit.
The slope of disillusionment.
You're like, what are these systems? You just look at it.
I mean, the incentive structure is different than any other industry you get exposed to.
It's brutal. And now it's a lot easier because of things like EHRs to frankly, just more awareness. But at the time, they made a bunch of intros. We went and talked to a bunch of people. And I remember Krishna at one point being like, yeah, everybody else we made these intros to came back and was like, we're going to do the ad tech thing again.
Yeah.
We really liked it. We liked the complexity. And so we were constantly pitching little ideas to them, and it took 18 months or 12 months or something like that, but eventually honed in on this like one very niche specific thesis around not just like EHR data, but specifically unstructured data in the EHR, the PDFs, the notes, the stuff that wasn't like in a standardized field.
I want to talk about like the actual idea of Flatiron, but you have an interesting process of discovering product market fit or learning about things, right? Where you go talk to a bunch of experts and then realize they aren't actually experts, but one person maybe is. Like, can you talk about like how you've thought about internalizing like learning an industry? Because you were coming from ad tech into healthcare, right? And so how did you actually ramp on that?
Yeah, and then we actually just did this again with Curie. Yeah. You know, my thesis on any industry is like there's a set of information that's available that you can like read. And then there's the inside information. And the inside information is typically not written down because A, it's complicated and annoying to write it down. So most people don't do it. And then it's only available to like the people who really understand it. And like, why are they going to write it down? Like, yeah. It's an incentive thing, right? Like if you know something special, why would you share it with everybody else? And so the trick is to understand the physics. I think of it as like an industry is not to try and read everything, but to just go find the people who know it the best and then convince them to teach it to you because you're going to learn faster from, I think of it as like information, right? Like I can go and read all these things and try and piece it together myself, or I can go find the five people who have already read all of the things. Plus they have their own knowledge and have synthesized it, and I can just ask them to teach it.
And neither of us are big fans of reading large amounts of stuff, right?
Yeah,
much easier to learn talking to people and in that way, right?
Like, I'll read, but the only thing I get from reading this stuff typically is, like, topic areas.
Yeah.
I can't...
It, like, prepares you to go ask questions, but then the actual learning sort of comes from the questions and answers.
Yeah, so we just ran a process. We did it at Flatiron, and then we just did it again, which is like, all right, let's just go learn everything there is about this. And the way you do it is you go find the people.
Yeah.
It's all about the experts. And, you know, what you were mentioning is like the hit rate on those experts is really low because most people aren't experts. They think they are, but they're not. Or they think they understand something, but actually what they understand is something someone else told them. And you got to go find that person.
How do you figure out if someone's full of shit? Like they have all these, you know, Dr. MD, whatever, big job at HSS, or but they actually don't know the incentive structure of the health system.
Yeah, so we did this intuitively at Flatiron, meaning I didn't realize I was doing this. And so as a result, it was like less effective. And then at Curie, we do this explicitly. Those are maybe not the right words,
but
whatever. One we planned, the other one we didn't plan. The non-planned one with Flatiron was we just asked people, like, how does it work? And when you got an unsatisfying answer of, like, how something worked, and you said, well, how does that part work? And then you realize, like, okay, this person actually doesn't understand because you just kind of keep asking, like, well, how does that work and how does that work? And the beauty for us, at least, I think, and I'll talk about the better way, but at Flatiron was we actually didn't know how it worked and we weren't doctors. So it was really easy for us to show up in a room and be like, I don't know anything about this and not give up our credibility because we could basically be like, hey, remember we sold this company to Google? So like, we're not morons. And so people would engage and then we were just very comfortable saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
And that, to me, that was the trick. I was like, I don't know. I'll just show up in a room and say, I don't know how this works. Can you explain it to me? And then when someone says this, I'd be like, I don't really know what that means either. What I learned from one of my Curie co-founders is there's a better way to do this or a little more efficient. Which is you ask people how they know. And it's just like the dumbest, simple, I can't believe I spent 10 years of my life not asking this question. And then, you know, after we had sold a company for $2 billion, I still didn't know how to do this. That's how I knew there's always somebody better than you. And Tom taught it to me. And he's basically like, yeah, if you talk to somebody and they say, well, this thing is true, just ask them how they know it. And you're like, oh yeah, that's like the best. And then most people will say, well, I heard it or I read it. And then you say, okay, where did you read it? And then they're lying and, or they don't really know. But the ones who do know, they're like, oh, I'll show you exactly how I know it and I'll teach it to you. But you just have to be very comfortable asking that question because it's a very awkward question to ask somebody because you're kind of insinuating that you don't believe them. And so you just have to get really good at asking the question in a non-antagonistic way, which is more of an EQ skill. It took me a while to figure that out. Because I know, like, if I'm in with somebody, I can definitely come off as, like, aggressive, which I'm aware of. So I try to, like, mute it with a joke or something. We just worked on these skills of, like, all right, how do I get someone to explain how they know something? And then the other thing Tom taught me was if I said to you, you know, what's the average contract value of RAMP or whatever, and you're like, well, it varies. Most people will just stop at that. Oh, I don't know, it varies. And actually, you can kind of guide people to give more specific answers. So I'd say, okay, well, is it like closer to a dollar or $100,000? And they say, oh, okay, it's like way closer to a dollar. And you go, okay, is it like closer to $5,000 or what? And you can kind of guide people to a more specific answer if you give them choices.
Parameters within. It's a funny thing. If someone doesn't want to tell you something, right, and you throw something out that you know is wrong, but you're not exactly sure, you know, Zach, how, whatever, how big do you think Curie can be? And you're like, oh, well, I don't know, it can be big. And I'm like, right, but like $10 million probably, right? And you're like, no, way bigger.
Way bigger.
Like, yeah. like at least five. And you didn't want to tell me originally, but when I framed it so low, it forced you to correct me, right? No one wants to let you sit out there with false information as well. It's like an interesting thing to get information from people.
And this little tactic, not the only one, but we used like at Curie when we were first doing homework on it, which was, you know, this core thesis that like, yes, drug discovery is expensive, but the cost to do it was coming down. And you would talk to people and they'd say, oh, well, drug discovery is expensive. It's really expensive. How expensive? And they're like, I don't know. It's like, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Well, is it five or 30? Right. And you would just kind of like slowly and then say, well, this part's really expensive. Okay. How expensive is that part? And then you figure out, the cost is over here, the cost is over here. You're kind of building this mental model of what the actual true facts are rather than like people's perceptions of those facts. The other thing, there's this like subtle, I think of it as a momentum thing, which is as you, this is the third thing I learned from Tom. So basically,
we're going to talk about Tom in a second. We've given some lessons of Tom, but maybe just because we're referencing him, Tom is one of the more interesting people I've met in my life, and effectively a co-founder. Is he actually?
No, he's a full co-founder. Okay. Tom was the co-founder of a startup that I was an investor in called Imogen, which is focused on enabling primary care docs to have diagnostic superpowers, basically like bringing diagnostics, things like x-ray, fundoscopy, diabetic retinopathy scan, whatever, a set of diagnostic tools to the primary care doc that typically could not do it on their own. He was a co-founder of that business. I was an angel investor, and then a board member, now still a board member. And yeah, I just got to know him through like,
one of the more interesting, smart people. Like last time we were here, actually, an hour before, I sat with him at a bar. There was like 50 other people there that I should have been talking to. And I was just so fascinated by him, like how his mind works. He doesn't have any news apps. He doesn't only learns from first party sources or whatever.
Well, he just does this process, but like all the time.
Yeah.
Only thing he does.
He'll just like learn from a root level up and then just keep verifying all of this stuff.
Right? Yeah. And I got to know him from being, founders in the same city and realized like, wow, I thought I was like pretty good at this, but like this, he's better.
So what was the third thing that you learned from him?
Oh yeah. So he's the one that taught me to ask like, how do you know? And then he's the one that taught me to do the sides. By the way, this is all post Flatiron, to be very clear. Like this is all things I learned after we had sold it. The third one is that as you do this little fact-finding mission, now you become an interesting source of facts. And there's this like, and so now when you go to the next person, you have something compelling to share with them that gets them engaged and gets them interested because you know something they don't know. And you see this momentum build where now when you're talking to an expert, you actually have something to share, which gets them to engage, which gets them to share more. And that's how you get to the cycle where you know everybody. Because by the 15th or maybe it's 50th or whatever conversation, you've learned like little nuggets all along the way. So like I can tell you really interesting things about, the cost of drug discovery or the failure modes or like how the economics of these venture funds work because I learned them as I was doing it. I could use that in the next conversation, share it. That person's like, oh, okay, maybe this person isn't an idiot. Like I just learned something. And then they are more likely to share. You just have to do the work.
Yeah.
Like just tons of calls. That's it.
And you did this intuitively with Flatiron and got to the point that people were saying to you over and over again, I put stuff in and I can't get it in.
Yeah,
right?
That phrase. Yeah, exactly.
And finally you got to the root of like what they meant, which was basically there's unstructured information going in through dictation, through handwritten notes, through whatever. It's going into this EHR. And on the other side, they want insights about that unstructured information.
Yeah, they want to ask questions. And they want to ask questions not of one patient, but of multiple. And so, I put data in. What data? which data. And that's what we realized. We realized that the unstructured data had a lot of critical information in it.
The unstructured information would be like
doctor's note.
Doctor wrote down, hey, patient is doing this, this, and this, and showing signs.
The simplest thing to think about, and this is in oncology, but it's true in other areas too. The narrative, I met so-and-so, she has this diagnosis, we talked about this thing, we're going to, so like what the docs, sometimes they'll dictate it. You could think the results of a scan, so of imaging, where the actual radiology report that comes back is like, it's a PDF.
Yeah.
And in some kind of cases, it's actually like faxed and scanned in. Pathology reports, so when they're actually looking at the tumor tissue itself, again, PDFs. And so in these documents were and are critical information about the patient and their disease, the treatments that they were receiving, and then the outcomes, what happened, right? Like, did they get, broadly speaking, better or worse? And there's a lot of nuance in like how you define better or worse and what data and the language people use. But basically we're like, oh, all this data is like in here, but we just assume it's like untenable to ask questions of because it's in like a narrative format. And going back to the thesis of like, well, tech people know some things better. I looked at that and I'm like, okay, that's just like a data curation problem. And if you build custom tools, like software tools for data curation, you can take things that take hours and turn them into minutes because you just like, you're not in Excel and tabbing between multiple screens and you can do really smart like task allocation and all just stuff I had seen. It's not rocket science. Like you just seen it at Google. They had used tools to tag spam, and they had like lots of reviewers in India who were doing this, and it worked really well.
So who wanted the insights of this? So the right. Doctors clearly put stuff in, but who was the other side of this?
Yeah, the final leg of the stool, if you will, that we needed to figure out was everybody had said, well, look, pharma would be really interested. Pharma would be really interested. And you heard, that's like the third thing someone tells you is like, yeah, I bet pharma would want to know this too. And so we just had to figure out what that meant as well. And this was helping to tease out what the use cases were for pharma, because that's where the revenue would come from. And we came up with this like ultra complicated business model that in like an era of free money works, and then in an era of like high interest rates probably doesn't work as well, where you would like, it was a loss leader business to get the data, and then you try and clean the data and then like make it back with pharma, which makes sense conceptually, but it's really expensive to like do the first two things. Plus, it's actually more expensive than I realized to sell to pharma because they're hard to sell into and you need, reasonably sophisticated salespeople. Like our salespeople were not cheap. That was the structure we put together. But the other side was pharma, and the use cases vary. There's a few of them, but the best two to think about in general. One is I have a drug that was approved in a clinical trial with a reasonably narrow set of types of people. And the FDA says you get an indication for your drug. I can use it on these people. But then actually what happens in the real world is it gets used in a much broader context than that, because the docs are allowed to give the patients, they can prescribe off-label. And then also what ends up happening is the patients who show up don't look just like the ones in the trial. They're sicker. They're less white. They can be older. There's a lot of like different characteristics about the real people versus the trial people.
And so the trial is a very controlled process where you get very structured data that comes out, right, for the pharma company, basically. Like,
yeah.
Hey, how the government's involved, how this drug actually works, there's different stages. And
the best way to think about it is you randomize two groups. One gets the drug, one gets effectively what is standard of care. It doesn't mean no drug, it just means standard of care. And because you've done this randomly, you've teased out all the different, this is that whole stupid Twitter argument I got into.
You saw me smirking. You knew that was the Keith Raboy smirk.
We can talk about how software people don't understand randomization. But the point of it is that the reason a drug works, you want to tease out whether it's the drug or it happens to be the type of people who want the drug, right? Because if you don't test randomly, the reason the drug may look like it's working is because the people who want it are healthier.
Yeah.
And there's a variety, these are called confounders, and there's a variety of reasons why that might be true. It could be something genetic that you can't even observe because you just don't even realize it exists. So anyway, you randomize, you get your two arms, you can compare the two, and you typically are comparing things like how long someone lived, in oncology at least, or tumor shrinkage, which is called tumor response. But then the trial is like a certain type of person, and real people don't look like trial people. So there's variability when you come out in the real world, and then we would.
And it's getting out in the wild, and now they're saying we actually need to close the loop to figure out what. Now we have much more data points, but it's no longer controlled from a variable standpoint.
Right, and so it's like, well, why do they care? And the answer is, well, because they get pressure on payment and reimbursement from payers, especially internationally. They also want to inform their sales and marketing efforts. They want to inform other trials they may want to run because, you know, maybe there's this area where it like looks like it's working, but they actually haven't run a trial. So there's reimbursement challenges, but hey, this could be like a trial we prioritize. A variety of those issues. And a lot of it had to do with reimbursement. And then there's a secondary use case that we worked on, which was, okay, if you consider the real world today as what would be the control arm in a trial, right? Because if you think of a clinical trial, you have the new thing compared to the current thing. Well, the current thing we measure in real time because we have all the data happening. And so could we estimate what that current thing would be? Because if you can estimate it, pharma can better design trials. They'll know with higher chance, higher likelihood if the drug will work theoretically. Because you just have better insight into what your comparative point is going to be. Think of it as like your competition.
Sure.
In the trial, right, is basically, are you better than what's happening right now? And a lot of times you're not, by the way.
And so initially your vision is, hey, we're gonna go and these hospital systems have EHRs and we're gonna help them get data out of that. And then we'll sell something to them and we'll sell them that way. But then we'll take those insights, package it up and
go to pharma.
And sell it to pharma. And that would actually be where the money was made.
Yep.
And that worked.
Yep.
To a point. And then you decided that there was a way of accelerating this by buying your own EHR, right?
Yeah, it was actually the other way around.
Okay.
We knew pharma was interested, but we kept getting the feedback of like, you don't have enough data. And which makes sense when you really think in detail, because you're like, oh, I've got like X thousand, you know, patients in the cancer centers we had signed up, but cancer's not a disease. It's like a disease characteristic almost. And so they're like, yeah, but how many of them are third line metastatic breast cancer who have seen this drug before and have this? And you're like, oh, right, that's like three people.
Yeah.
So you need a much bigger sample size. And we had this idea for a shortcut, which was to go buy one of the oncology electronic health record providers that happened to be in market, that happened to be privately owned, that happened to be run by two guys who were like later in their career and wanted to cash out. Was not more than like 100 million. You know, it's just like everything you could possibly get lucky and ask for was true about the makeup of this market. And so we came up with this idea to go and buy it because we felt like without owning it, the path to having enough data was going to be years.
Was the business working before that?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it was working in the sense that we proved we could do it at small scale.
Yeah.
We had gotten data. We had showed that we could build data curation tools. We built the data curation tools. We could show that we could use them. We had oncology nurses abstracting, and we showed demand from pharma, at least like indications of interest. So you're kind of like, this can work if you just like throw a bunch of more data at it. And so we were running at that problem.
How many people were you at that point?
25
and
or 30.
Had raised
$10 million.
And so you go and pitch this to a bunch of people and say, hey, we need $100 million plus. And
we only pitched it to two people.
Oh, and both said yes.
Both said yes.
Okay. So you go and say, hey, we need $130-ish million. 30 is going to go to us and 100 is going to go out the door right away.
30 to operate this thing after we buy it.
Yeah, yeah. 30 to the business.
To the business.
The way you normally think about venture capital.
Right.
And
right, not a secondary on the round.
Not the last couple of years of venture capital.
No.
And then $100 million is going out the door to these people that we've met and we like them and, you know, it seems like a good fit. And so then the term sheet's contingent on
Closing the acquisition. Ran them in parallel.
So both people said yes. GV ended up leading the
GV
round.
GV led it, yeah.
$130 million going to your bank account one day.
Yes.
And a couple hours later, $100 million goes out to these guys.
Yeah, we took a picture of the 130 because it was cool. You're like, look at this. And then it's gone. You know, because we're still pretty young at the time.
How do you actually value that? How did you value that? Yeah, okay.
I mean,
it worked out for GV.
You know, how do you guys do valuations on like...
Scientific, very, very clear. Yeah. But I mean, it's unusual because like you sort of need to get credit for the thing that's already... Yeah.
I mean, we kind of said... We we want to do this acquisition. We don't want to take more dilution than would be normal for a round of this size, which is like, you know, 30, 40%. And so, okay, we're asking for like, I don't know what it was, 210 pre, yeah, something like that. And then we had two bidders. So, you know, that's how you get it.
A little bit, yeah.
Both bidders were real. The other one was Andreessen. And, you know, so those are like two legitimate groups. They know each other. They know like the other one's not joking. And so we ended up going with GV just because they were already on the cap table and we knew the partner there really well. And the Andreessen partner, not Mark himself, but the partner on the team, we didn't know as well, and he didn't have healthcare experience. So we liked GV better for this problem. You know, if we were building like enterprise SaaS, we probably would have went with Andreessen. But in healthcare, we wanted GV. So we did that deal. Yeah. And it was tricky because we also had to convince the founders of the company we were buying that we had the money, because we didn't. And so we actually ended up running this process where we included GV in the conversation on the acquisition so that the company we were buying knew we weren't full of shit, essentially. So like we brought them all together in California. They all met. GV was like, yes, we want to do this within, you know, financial reason. We negotiated. We thought it was going to be 70 million and it ended up being 100. Because the founders had other offers.
They did. Wow.
Yeah, there was another company.
With financing contingency like this, you figure they would have taken the other offers.
We did a really good job of explaining this money is real.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, we brought them to the Google office.
Sure.
Like, it's something compelling. You know, you're in the Google office. There's a bunch of like fancy snacks, whatever. Yeah. You realize like, okay, yeah, Google has a lot of money.
Massages.
Right. We didn't do the massages in the meeting, but maybe after. So I think we mitigated that perceived risk at least. And yeah, we closed back to back. Basically, we closed both effectively on the same day.
And did it work right away? Like once you had it? So this is now what, 2014.
I've
never heard of any other deal like this, by the way. Have you like come across another venture deal in the last 10 years that has drawn parallels? I mean, there's a bunch of weird things, right? Using something as a wedge, you ultimately use the EHR that you bought as a wedge, loss leader, to build this other business that you monetize, which I can't even think of too many that do that. Plaid has some elements like that, I guess.
They bought their competitor, but they bought it when they were much bigger.
But Plaid has a little bit of like, they did work for the banks to help them get their data out to then monetize the other way. But like, it's not a perfect analogy. So even that is like a weird thing, let alone buying something else.
Yeah, there are some corollaries in terms of business model, but not in the like, we go and buy this like existing tool set and then build on top of it. At least not that I've found. We didn't like really look too hard just because, you know, healthcare is its own thing.
Sure. And no one else has brought it up or come to you and said, hey, how did you do that?
Like, I've definitely had founders of our portfolio companies, like our angel investing companies, who are like looking at doing M&A, and they always call me. That I get a phone call for all the time of like, how can I think about this? But usually they're adding on, like, oh, I want to go into this market, and they've got something big and established already. Or what they're doing is they're like buying their supplier.
Yeah.
They're going upstream.
Verticalizing.
Yeah, exactly. And so I haven't seen anything that looks like this. Exactly. It was odd. It was a crazy idea. I mean, I remember...
I would have told you if I were on your board, this was like a terrible idea.
No, it's funny you say that because it was Nat's idea. What you'll learn very quickly is none of these things are my ideas. And then like, I just do the dirty work, I guess.
You're
like,
the henchman.
Nat came up with the idea to buy the CHR. Tom came up with the idea for Curie. And then I was like, all right, I guess I'll like do the work. But yeah, it was Nat's idea. And then I remember turning to him and be like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever, like, no fucking way this company is going to sell it to us. I was obviously wrong.
Let alone like taking ownership of their code, and did people come along?
See, that's not the part that scared me. That's actually why I bought into it pretty quickly, because I looked at it and was like, okay, I know how to run this business. I know how to like run an enterprise software company, and it's effectively what this was. And we knew the customers better than they did. We could figure out the tech. It's not rocket science. We had a great CTO who was excited about it. I just didn't think they would sell and we could get the
fund.
I mean, because Nat was like, I don't know, let's go raise $100 million. I'm
like,
dude, we have no revenue.
Yeah.
We have zero. The dollars of revenue are zero. And so like, how the hell is someone going to do this?
You probably couldn't have done this in a different market if you hadn't had prior success of like in today's interest rate environment, right? Like all these things were sort of right place, right time without the EHR happening, the EHR movement that happened through Obamacare. And
the fact that we had sold a company before, the fact that there were low interest rates and money was like reasonably free, and that Google knew us, I think was the other one, because we had known them for a very long time. So yeah, a lot of stuff comes together at the same time. I mean, in hindsight, a lot of these, you know, you were like, wow, we got lucky with a bunch of pieces of this, and so be it. Also, you know, we got very lucky in the sense that when we sold the company, we sold it like at one of the market peaks. There was competition. You know, people were still doing these like revenue multiple things, which is obviously what we got. So definitely wasn't an earnings multiple, that's for sure. Yeah, just good timing. And now part of this is like listening to the people and understanding where the soft spots are and realizing like, okay, this is good timing, because, you know, we knew this was good timing to buy the company because we knew that that people were going to recognize there was value here. So we're like, now's the time to do this. And then we also recognized when we were selling it that this was like a good time to sell, because we felt like we were in peak hype for real world evidence, and it was going to be a lot of expensive work and time consuming work to build a public company, and Roche was a good buyer.
And so you sold in 2018 for $1.9 billion, and then you stayed on for...
Three years, yeah.
And so then Curry starts to be... You're going to go retire, and the infamous Tom Hotchkiss comes and says, hey, I've got this idea.
Yeah, well, you know, the last year of Flatiron was during COVID. So, you know, like, people are... It was just chaos. I was doing angel investing on the side. I wasn't like retire in the sense of like go and sit on the beach, but
retire in the way that I'm retired.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Gonna go be a career.
I was going to be a career VC, which is what was that? 4 hours a week.
Yeah, that's right.
And a podcast. So
yeah.
And
what could have been, man?
50% podcast, 50% investing, and I'd been chatting with Tom a lot because I was on the board of his company and helping them. And it was one of the more interesting companies that I had been supporting, probably the most interesting. And we had been talking about, or I'd always been interested in going earlier in drug discovery, because at Flatiron, you know, we were in drug development.
Yeah, post-trial.
Yeah, like right around when the trial and then the drug's approved. But like by the time the product, in this case, obviously the drug, comes to us, it's already locked, right? Like the chemical structure is known. And that you know, you look at the other side, you're like, that's actually where the interesting stuff happens, but like, I don't really touch that.
Prior to Curry being a thing, how does that actually happen? Maybe go through the life cycle of how drug discovery occurs.
Well, I didn't know, actually. You know, in a funny way, like I'd been in healthcare for 10 years and I'd been in drug development for a while, but actually like the process of doing, you know, early stage drug discovery was kind of foreign to me. And Tom and I had been chatting about a variety of different things, mostly like his idea. You know, he has these ideas, and then he would come pitch me as like a feedback source. And I, you know, this is good, this is bad, whatever. And I don't remember the exact original like insight he had, but it was something along the lines of like the, because he's got these like financial takes on them, which are really useful. But, you know, you have these interesting innovations that are coming out of academia and out of these labs, and that what ends up happening is this was his take, the institution, it becomes an LP and a fund, and the LP, the fund itself, takes the technology out and turns it into a company. And so basically, at a high level, the institution is paying a company a fee for its own technology. That was it's like, you know, that's not exactly true, but it was this idea of like, why are there these middlemen, companies, these venture incubators that sit between the money that this institution already has and a potential idea? Like, why is that the case? It shouldn't be the case, because in a high functioning market, those companies would be fundable when they get formed. Look at software, right? Like, we don't license, you know, we don't have to like form these companies. These companies get formed on their own. And that felt weird, right? Like, why is that happening?
And so the actual, if you were to give an example, so just to drill into that. So someone is working at an academic research center and they have an insight.
Let's just talk about like why. So I'll tell you the conclusion, if you will, of why this is. The core thesis basically is that you can't start a therapeutics company in your garage. And the reason for this is that it is expensive and time consuming, and there are a lot of places in early stage drug discovery where you're going from an idea to like some preclinical proof, a set of experiments basically that show that this could work. In that little journey in early stage drug discovery, if you make a mistake, and there's like layers of places you can make a mistake, the company's over, effectively over. In software, that is not true, right? Because in software, if you make a mistake in the product, you just go and fix it because that fix is software code.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, we teach founders in software to just go and fix it, right? That's the lean startup. But here the problem is that fix is like months of time and money and experiments.
If you misset variables in the trial or whatever.
No, we're preclinical. We're almost like pre-animal.
Got it.
You know, like many of our companies will get to a mouse, but that's about it. You design the wrong experiment. You pick the wrong vendor. You don't catch a mistake in the physical assay they're running. You pick the wrong target. You have this interesting technology, but you try and go after like a target in a disease that doesn't work, right? Because you know, there's just all these places where you have to make these decisions that are very difficult to unwind. There's a lot of like, what are the Bezos ones? I always forget. Yeah. The irreversible doors.
Yeah, one-way doors.
I don't remember which
one. I always use toothpaste out of the tube. Like, right, you can't put it back in.
Yeah, there's a lot of toothpaste out in this case. And so there's so many places that you can make mistakes. And those mistakes are deadly. And they're hard to avoid.
Deadly to the company.
To the company.
And maybe the mouse.
Potentially to the mouse. Yeah. They're just hard to avoid because you need years and years of experience and you need access to people. You need to be able to talk to people and vendors who help you avoid those mistakes because you actually have to do a lot of planning. And so that's actually what the gap is. And as a result, what evolved in biotech, not incorrectly, by the way, is a set of venture incubators that we call them, you know, we think venture capital fund because they're structured like a fund in the sense they have LPs and they raise money. But actually, really what they do is like, they become the founders of the company, right? They do a lot of the heavy lifting. They recruit in the team. They help design experiments to a point. I mean, it's more team building than anything else. They kind of pitch it as like we do a lot, but it's really more team building. But the trade-off of all this work that this venture fund is doing is that they take control and they take ownership. And so, as they should, right? Like, they're doing a lot of work and they're putting usually like $30, $40, $50 million into these companies. And so they end up owning the majority of them. There's no real founder. There's no real entrepreneur. So your choice is like, this is what we discovered. I could go do this with this like incubator and own like a little piece of my own thing that's not really mine. And it's not mine right away. Or I can try and do it on my own. Like you can, it's not the only way to do this, right? Like you can go raise venture capital from plenty of VC funds who might fund a therapeutics company at the seed. But look at the team. Yeah. Look at the people at that fund. Like, does anyone have drug discovery experience? Is it one person has it? Or like it's a set of associates who are probably more junior than the founders. And so you give up the help, which means your chances of mistakes are higher.
This is not dissimilar to venture in the 80s, 90s.
That's like, kind of how I think about it.
There's a lot of parallels to Cisco as an idea at Stanford University and Sequoia Investing and bringing in professional CDOs and all that, right?
Before it was easy, and I do really think starting a software company at this point in time is easy. Before it was easy, it was hard. And as a result, yeah, you had a very limited number of firms. They did a lot more work. It was a little more heavy-handed. They wrote bigger checks, more concentrated portfolios, more risk. And so the industry was just a lot smaller, right? This is like pre-cloud. That's what software was. And then costs come down, tools get better, it gets easier. You can spend more money on the product and rather than the infrastructure, and you see like market explodes.
Yeah. And part of this is the feedback loops were long. The upfront investment was high. The sophistication of the founding team was low.
You had to
low.
Build a data center.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know.
Or you had to literally chip CDs. Like, you know.
Totally. Yeah. Time to, like, if you think of the rubric or the metric is like time to customer feedback, you know, in the 90s, what is that? 2 years, three years? In even like the late 90s, early 2000s, still probably two, three, a year. I mean, it's a while. Now it's what, 4 days?
Yeah.
You like mock it in Figma, you like stick it, you know, it's like so easy to do this stuff now. In biotech, the equivalent rubric would be time to first experiment, right? Like how much time and money do I have to spend to like get to that first experiment? And that stuff has been shrinking over time. You can do more with outside vendors, but it's missing, well, which experiment and why? And like making sure it's done. There's still this missing gap, and that's what these incubators have helped provide, mostly by connecting you to the right people. we thought you could do this in a different model where you could help the founders make fewer mistakes by basically building what looks like a team of the world's best drug discovery experts. It's team, right? So we're building what is like a team of 60 or so core drug discovery scientists, right? These are less investors, more scientists. Now we do investing, we have investing partners, but the rest of the team are people who have been in the trenches in drug discovery in a biotech recently, meaning like they were either in the lab or guiding the lab. They've been making those mistakes themselves, also hopefully making some good decisions. It's the equivalent of like, imagine somebody brought the infrastructure of a late stage biotech to you for your idea. That's the idea. But we'll also do it in seed, right? We'll write you a check. So instead of writing like $100 million check and taking over the thing, we'll write a smaller seed check, which allows you as the founder to own more of your own company because you don't dilute as much, make fewer mistakes, and then have a better round at the A and a better round at the B. But the key to the whole thing is this like services entity, right? It's this idea of we basically can take you from like concept to A.
It's sort of the, I mean, YC is the parallel that I draw on,
yeah,
but it'd be YC in the 90s, right? With like much more hands-on service around.
I would think it's like if YC wrote you the full seed check, co-developed the product with you, talked to customers with you, did some sales, you know, debugged your software, helped write tests, put your pitch deck together, and then got you the A.
Yeah.
That's like the equivalent if YC did real work. And wrote a bigger check and took more risk. So yes, in the sense, like, I think of YC as like culturally aligned in that we believe in founders and we believe in incentives and we believe in being the first phone call. That's about where the comparison probably ends. And like,
especially today, like maybe we could draw parallels back to the way the industry used to work and what it could have been if YC existed back then.
Yeah.
And so is the vision now, so how big is the fund?
270.
270. And you're going to do how many deals out of that?
35-40
deals. And so that's going to be over 3 years?
Yeah, something like 2.5 years, 3 years.
How many have you done so far?
4.
And do you plan to keep, like, what is the profile of these people when they come to you? Do they stay on as CEOs? Do you help them recruit CEOs? What is that? Is that going to be an evolution over time? Do you want them to stay in the seat? How does that work?
We try not to have a strong opinion about there's one way to do this. I think our view on this is each company is a little different. The context is different, the risks are different, and so we will work with the founders to figure out the best plan for your business to maximize the value of your equity.
Is there an idealistic sentiment like there is in Silicon Valley in tech and software about like being the founder CEO, or is it less so in bio?
It's almost swung the other way a little bit, where I think the perception is the founders, the scientific founders, can't be the CEOs, and there's actually some good reasons why being a biotech CEO is significantly harder to learn fast or quickly than being a tech CEO.
What are some of those?
There's just so many more operational problems you have to work on in biotech. Like the width of the problem space you have to work on is a lot broader and the talent pool is smaller. And so it's just harder to like get the best people in all the places. Cause in tech, like how many great sales leaders are there? 5,000. There's so many people you can go and recruit because the market's so big. Here, the talent pools are tighter, the expertise, you have to be in the industry for a lot longer to be good at this. So it's just, I think of it as like your path is a little harder to knock out. There's also like the history, you know, of look, what makes you a great scientist doesn't necessarily make you a great CEO.
Sure.
It's not like being a software engineer where you go to school for 4 years and really 2 years at this point because these kids are so good. You know, to be good at drug discovery, you're doing this for like 20 years before you can really, you know, be an expert. I think our thesis is let's see what makes sense for this company. I think we're going to have a distribution. Some founders can do it and want to do it. Some founders can do it, but they need guidance and you bring in a CEO and maybe they ride shotgun. Some founders don't want to do it at all and you bring in a CEO early. It just depends. My take on it is, we have this weird habit in biotech of trying to build the team before we have any data, which I never understood because like, why would the best people join the company before it has any data? So the way they attract the best talent is they shove a bunch of money in.
And take a bunch of dilution.
All the dilution, right? Like you're basically like, all right, this is, you know, we're gonna put $80 million into this thing right up front and like the founders aren't really in control anymore, and they own like a really tiny piece, but that $80 million is going to attract talent. And that works for the fund, but it doesn't really work great for the founding team. So our theory is, well, what if we didn't put $80 million in right away? Like, what if we put eight, and then we made real progress for that eight in the seed? That's what our team does, right? We help you make the right progress. And then we go and raise more money at a higher price for less dilution. And by the way, there's this like secondary benefit where the people who you do need to recruit at a certain point, because our team can't take you all the way through, now they're interested because now you have data. It's like showing up and saying, I have this idea versus showing up and saying, I have this idea. I've done these experiments. Here's what the data shows. Like,
I have customer feedback that validates the product. The dogs will eat the dog food.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're going to get better people. And you're going to get better people because you have more to show and it's less risky. And plus, you also have a bigger cap table in terms of founder ownership. So you can give bigger equity grants. It's just like structurally a better business that way. The reason it hasn't happened is not because, you know, people haven't thought of this. It's just really hard. It's really hard to make progress at the seed because the experts don't pay attention to you. The vendors don't pay attention to you. Designing the plans are hard. Knowing, you know, stuff that's happened in pharma that hasn't been written down is hard. It's just information is missing. That's what we do. We kind of like bridge that gap. You know, it's really, in a funny way, it's like similar to many of the things I learned of there's a set of expertise that's sitting out there that's better than you know always. Getting it is really hard. It takes a lot of time and effort. Well, we just like sit in the middle between the founder and that expertise. Sometimes it's technical expertise. Sometimes it's just knowing the history. And we can cut that time to learning, that time to the right answer down by 95%. And that's actually how it's playing out. I mean, we knew this would be we believe this would be true. It's playing out that it's true at small scale. And so now it's just a question of, is Curie viewed as a high quality option for founders? Because if it is, if all of a sudden you're sitting in, maybe you're in biotech or you're in academia and you've got an idea, and right now you're like, well, what the fuck am I going to do with this idea? Like, where do I go? And like, all those options aren't particularly great. Our hope is we look like a new option. And you go, well, I'm not 100% sure if this is a company yet, but let me go call Curie. We look at the idea. We're like, oh, this is really interesting, or not. Let us help shape and mold this with you and then get it set up in a world where you actually can make the leap. And I think if we do that, our thesis is net new founders. That's this whole like pithy free to founders thing.
That's what I was going to ask is how much do you think is cannibalizing or stealing from people that otherwise would be founders versus unlocking the founder that wouldn't have been because it's incrementally easier to get going or validate the ideas? Like the 45, and I realize it's going to be a swag and it's a spectrum and who knows where the tipping point is for them to actually do it. But like, is it... If 45 is at 10 and 35, 10 would have been otherwise and 35 wouldn't have been? Or is it 35, 10? Or is it, I know there's an idealistic state and I'm sure it'll change over time.
I don't think we know. I think all we know is that, yes, like it's both.
There will be some.
Yeah, exactly.
Whoever it is at the margin, it will be easier for them to get going.
I think we'll see things like, you know, the postdoc who would have tried to start it like through the lab director in this model where the postdoc is an employee is now like, wait a minute, why don't I just try and do this myself? I think you'll see people who would have been brought in as one of those early employees decide, wait a minute, why don't I go hunt the idea down myself so I can own, you know, 10x the equity? So I think we'll see that kind of stuff. In addition to like, this company is just normally getting formed and this is a better option for them. I think we'll just see like more organic market making activities essentially, or the market will solve it over time. And there's some ideas that wouldn't have gotten off the ground because there's like a set of annoying work you have to do in the beginning and nobody wanted to do it, or we didn't have the bandwidth to do it as an industry or whatever. The firm that would have done it had a bad day, but here we are. So I think it's all of those things. It's just going to take a little bit of time for people to realize that we are an option and a good one. So, you know, that's on us. Like, we have to make everybody aware. We have to continue to build our team. We're 20, 25 people. We'll be 60 soon. And then we actually have to do the work. We have to, like, you know, everything I just said is the story. And we've been doing it now. We have these four companies, and we're in diligence probably another 10. We just have to do the work.
And you're constraining the terms, right? So remind me, it's
roughly 5-7 for about 33% of the equity. And then we take additional risk by providing all the services end to end, all the way through to the A, right? This isn't like advice. This is like we're literally designing the plan with you. You can think of it almost like a co-founder.
Yeah.
We take 7.5% founder common for this. So we take no cash, right? We don't like hand you money and then charge it back, which is what some of the other funds do. We hand you a bunch of money. We say we want 95% of that money to go to the experiments. Like if you look at the budgets of these companies, almost all of the money goes to the experiments because there's people you don't have to hire now. We do it for you. Right? There's legal work you don't have to do. We've already done it ahead of time. You don't have to do contracting. You don't have to do NDA. Like we did all this infrastructure for you, just focused on the science. We provide all of that help cashless. We take 7.5% equity for it, meaning, and the way I frame this to founders is like, we are the single most aligned seed investor you could ever possibly have. We only make money if you have a wild success. And by the way, we've burned cash to do this work for you, right? So we're extra incentivized for you to have a good outcome because we're actually like out additional money beyond the investment. So founders will own somewhere around 60-ish percent, depending on the split among their own team. We'll own about 40 heading into the A. And then if we do our job, you're taking less dilution at the A, you're taking less dilution at the B, at a much higher quality idea with a higher chance of success, right? It's not just about dilution at seed. I think people get very confused about like, yeah, but what if I could get better seed terms? Like, cool. Enjoy getting crushed at the A when you didn't make real progress. Imagine, you know, your series A term sheet. This is like not atypical in biotech is 60 on 5, 80 on 10. Those are real rounds. Those happen all the time.
$80 million on 10 pre.
100%. Yeah. 100%. Now, are those the common?
No.
But yes, they happen because you have these companies that need a lot of money because they didn't prove that, you know, the idea could work at a level of rigor they could have done had they like really focused. The VC fund is saying, this is really interesting, but like there's so much risk in this business. I need to overcapitalize it so that we can continue to make some mistakes because you don't want to run out of cash and have to fundraise again. Here's a shit ton of money, but like we're going to take over this thing. You can go the other direction, right? You can do the seed thing on your own. But like, what happens after you've blown your seed money and you haven't made real progress?
I'm sure you'll have some great, I would imagine it's illustrative right now, but I'm sure you have some great, if you work with us, then here's what an A can look like. Here's what it can look like.
I mean, the best feeling is going to be when we just show
the data. Our series A's have a success rate of, you know, 90% or whatever it is. And then, and dilution terms of XYZ versus.
Totally. Yeah. And look, it's hard too, because this is an industry that doesn't know venture math super well. So we have education we need to do. But the point that I try to convey to founders when I get on a phone with them, if they need it, is you have to think of ownership over the trajectory of the company.
The end state of it.
Yes, because we don't do secondary cash outs in biotech we do. Exactly. Right. Yeah. That's true. Now they're gone. They're gone. There's no more Series B where the 80% of the money goes into the penthouse apartment. But so that doesn't happen. So you have to think about it at the end result, which means you have to think about like the trajectory of the business, which means you have to think of the progress at the seed leading to the A, leading to the B. The better you do in the seed, the better you do in the A, the better you do in the B. You actually will own more of your own thing. That's not always people don't always understand that that's true. Even when I explain it, it's not intuitive to a lot of folks. It's just hard, right? It's like, you know, you have to have tried it and failed.
Sure.
It's actually been really interesting. A lot of the people we've talked to that get the most excited about this are the first-time founders. It's like someone who's like, oh, for my next company, I'm definitely doing this.
Oh, you mean the existing people that you can't back?
They already got there to like, this was so fucking hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I had no idea.
The repeat people are coming back because they've walked through the woods on their own, and they're like, hey, I don't want to do that.
They've been like, oh yeah, you're right. I did send 75 emails to experts and 3 responded, or whatever the problem ended up being. Or like, I didn't fully appreciate, I had to get the strategy right at the, whatever.
The best part of venture in that is ultimately if you build that brand, then it could be true that you actually create that value. Or it could be true that the perception that you create that value then allows people more willing to pay that price later on, right? Which is one of the things I always wonder about, like the 8+ early stage venture investors. Like, do they have a higher success rate because of the help and guidance that they have, or because people like following them and building relationships with them and the work that...
You know, in biotech...
You have real service that you're adding, so I'm sure it's more evidential than...
It's more objective in biotech, too, I would say, because at the end of the day, the drug has to work.
Yeah.
And so you can run the hype train, you know, all right, let me follow like the best seed and stop, like pop in the middle and then sell it to the next guy. But what happens actually as these companies and the data gets more mature is like you see the data. Yeah. And so, you know, we can run on our reputation only for so long, but eventually it's like, oh yeah, no, it doesn't work.
Yeah. It's kind of true in venture as well. Like ultimately, what the valuation of the business is at its end state is.
I think biotech is a little bit more binary. I know it's a lot more binary.
Definitely more binary.
Because in tech also, you can see these companies where like the revenue's growing and it looks all good, but like actually when you look under the hood, it's like, okay, the margin's negative, or like it's really marketing dollars that are driving it. But you can kind of convince yourself that there's something here. It's like, oh yeah, no, we ran this tox study and like the tox is too much. We got to shut it down.
There's a binary scorecard.
It's more binary. It's not always binary, but it's more binary. And so I think it's harder to just reputationally win the next round. Like you do have to make real progress. And I think biotech investors, rightfully so, especially the ones that write the bigger checks, are like very strong skeptics about everything. The assumption is it doesn't work.
Yeah.
All right, and so prove to me that it could. Whereas I think in software, you kind of get a little bit more rose-colored glasses.
What about the upstream stuff that's going on at the molecular level or that's actually occurring in the industry? Like, why is now, I mean, it sounds good, like all this right. stuff. It seems like a service that should exist. What got you excited about the industry trends now? And then how does this actually impact, you know, downfield the number of drugs that you're hoping to actually have out?
I mean, we took like a very simple view of this, which is our understanding of biology, meaning how disease happens in the body, is just constantly getting better. And it's been getting better at a faster pace than ever before, right? We tools, everything from like sequencing to being super cheap, right? So you can learn more about like potential genetic drivers of disease, to understanding of the immune system, to CRISPR. There's so many different tools we now have to come up with creative ideas that we don't think the rate limiting factor in this business will be ideas, good ideas. It's going to be finding those ideas and getting them out and getting them in the right place. So we're making a bet that there are enough good ideas out there that if you shape and mold them are worth funding. And as a result, like all progress in biology is good for us. All progress in industrialization of biotech, meaning like there's a vendor who does this one thing and just does it super well. And now because they do it super well at scale, it's really cheap. We benefit because of that. Computation making its way into, okay, great. The stuff's going to be cheaper and more accurate. Like all of these things lend itself to capital efficient progress at the seed, right? If you kind of like synthesize it all down to like, so what? Like, why do these things matter? It's good ideas that if you know what you're doing, you can make a lot of progress for less money. 10 to 15 years ago, you would have had to do a lot of this work yourself. It would, even if you knew exactly what you're doing, I don't think you could have made the kind of progress we're talking about making for 8 million. It would have been 20, 30. So just more infrastructure available. I mean, this is capitalism at work.
And so the success rate of a portfolio, how do you think of 45 come through? Is it a real hits-driven thing?
Yeah, it's hits-driven.
That 3 to 5 drive 90% of the portfolio value?
There's nothing that would make me believe this looks any different than a typical early stage venture fund, in the sense that you fund 40, 20 are zeros. There's a bunch of singles and doubles that are nice to have, but you know, you add them all up and maybe you returned half the fund or something, maybe 1x, maybe 1x if you're really good at that. And that almost all of the real returns are driven by 1 to 3 big wins, maybe a triple in there. When this is true of all of seed investing, right? Like you've definitely had almost all seed funds. When you look at the distribution of returns in those funds, like it's one company or two companies that drive it. And if you got three, you're like, retired.
It's a hard thing to internalize that you can spend 99% of your time on stuff that doesn't do anything, and then that 1% is what makes up for everything else.
Because I know this, because I've done it in tech and I've watched it happen, we are very, I don't think this is rocket science, by the way. It's just we try and stick to it. We're very particular at making sure that when we analyze a seed investment, leave aside, for 1 second, leave aside the technical risk. Like, can it work? But if it works, is it a fund returner on the bull case? We will always make sure that if the thing plays out in the scenario, the bull case scenario, that it could return the fund, which means, you know, it's a $1 billion plus market cap type of opportunity and hopefully even bigger than that. And we try and make sure we can logically reason through, like, okay, if this goes well and this goes well and this goes well, yeah, like, we're good. Yeah.
If it works, it better work. For it to be the worth the time, effort,
yes,
energy, dollars.
And we're very comfortable saying there's a 20% chance this thing is going to work. Like, we're pretty sure it's going to fail. But if we're wrong, or if that 20% plays out, like, we're in great shape. And in almost all of the bets we've made to date, I would say that's kind of how we look at it. Like, I would bet there's one where, like, it's pretty clear, you know, it has a really, really good chance of working. It just came with this, like, very, very mature idea, and it's moving fast. The other three we only did very recently, and in all of them, I don't know, 50% chance or less. But, like, man, if it plays out, if the data looks compelling and good, you're looking at something that could easily be a multi-billion-dollar business, and that's the kind of risk we want to take because we think we can improve the chances of that hit happening.
Yeah.
Right? We can go from 5 to 20 or 20 to 40. And in all the cases so far, maybe I'm, like, full of ourselves now, but I truly believe we have changed the trajectory of each of these companies in some way that is giving it a much higher chance of success, either by getting them the right people, the right vendor, the right plan, some combination of all of those things, the right team. These companies have materially changed in some way from when we met them to where they are post-financing. And that's our hope, right? Is like that's a true statement in, you know, most all of the companies we end up funding.
To close the loop there, so they go public in the early stage of, like,
yeah, these companies will
go
public at
revenue?
Like, no.
Yeah.
Okay. No. They might have, like, some partnering revenue, but...
But it's based on the early evidence of whatever.
Yeah, this is all changing, but, like, usually the Series C, if you will, is either, like, could be an IPO.
Yeah.
So it varies on company by company basis. I just think of it as, like, you need to make progress through the drug discovery conveyor belt. It's kind of like a big conveyor belt, right? And, you know, if we do our job, obviously you're making more progress. Maybe you're shaving an entire round out because you just, like, cut out a bunch of mistakes you didn't need. But yeah, eventually they, you know, how do we get, I guess the question being, like, how do we get our money out? How does anybody get their money out? Is the company gets bought by pharma or goes public.
And there's this preciousness in Silicon Valley about going public, right? And it's something that people have sort of skewed away from. But back in your industry now, it's like just a part of the journey, and you do it super early.
It's a financing round.
How is that? Do you feel, having spent time in this, where people are just going public without revenue and just trusting public market investors? I assume there's a decent amount of volatility that exists, but mostly macro kind of industry level stuff. And then anytime an incremental progress is made, there's, you know, the price will shoot straight
Yeah,
up.
I mean, these things, they look like staircases, right?
Yeah.
You know, they look like elevators, and they go both directions too, down and up.
Definitely no evidence of insider trading that happens before those big breakthrough moments, I'm sure. But has it changed your perspective? Because you said, hey, it would have been a long path with Flatiron to go public. Like, would you have operated differently knowing what you know now? Or like, what's your perspective on the preciousness of IPOs now within the
space? In tech?
Yeah.
I think getting ready to be a public company is a good forcing function to be thinking about how you operate, you know, the controls you have in place, your comp structure, your culture.
Is that the same in biotech or no?
No, because in biotech, like, you know, you're going public, these companies have 30, you know, it's like the teams are smaller. You're going, like, literally you're going public mostly to raise money to run a trial. Like, the reason it's like the classic reason you would IPO is actually a financing process. So I think the logic and reasoning and what you have to believe in bio is completely different than in software. In software, it's more of a liquidity event because the people want their options to be worth something.
Yeah.
Because there's so much money in late stage tack that you can do private financing almost indefinitely. And so you don't have to go public. There's no pressure. Whereas, like, you know, biotech, late stage biotech in terms of dollars raised versus tech is probably like 1/100th of this. I mean, it's plenty of money, but it's not like tech. It's not like, you know, there's no SoftBank running around throwing, you know, $800 million into these companies. And then, by the way, it's not one SoftBank. There's like 30 of them here in tech, whereas in biotech, it's a lot smaller. So yeah, you have to use the public markets when you're ready. The knock on biotech IPOs is they've been happening without real data. They've been happening earlier in this. It's just like low interest rate shit, right? There's excess money. People want to speculate. So they buy speculative assets, crypto. One of those speculative assets historically has been like biotech that's probably too early to be public, but they did it anyway because the money was there. And that's why you see a lot of these public biotechs now trading, you know, significantly below their IPO price, in many cases below cash. Not always below cash, but like the shit ones trade below cash, basically. I don't have like a strong opinion in any direction. I just view it as like, if you have good data, good things will happen.
What's it been like to go from ad tech to healthcare to, you know, crypto guy to now bio?
It was like I had an affair and did crypto.
How funny is that actually? Has it actually come up in your day to day at all? Or
it can't. I mentioned this to you in passing. It came up in the fundraise with LPs because we were doing we didn't go into all the structure, but we raised money for two companies. We raised this like services company and then we raised the fund. So we raised like $500 million, but it was two entities. In the fundraise, it came up with a bunch of LPs. Because those LPs are allocating across everything, right? It's not just biotech. And one of the things they're allocating against is crypto. And so, you know, a subset would definitely mention. Some would like joke about it in the call, and then some would ask like real questions.
Are you distracted by anti-crypto?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in some way they were asking like, are you really focused on this? And I had to explain like, I don't prepare for this crypto thing. I just show up and do it. So don't worry. I think others were like genuinely interested and wanted to understand. One or two, I definitely got in a yelling match with, of like, the guy would tell me his bull case, and I would say, I don't know how else to tell you that you're wrong, but you're wrong. And then we would like have a little back. So, you know what's funny? Sometimes
did any of them come in that you yelled at? Or
there were like two cases. There's only two. I'm not an idiot. I don't like fight with LPs about this stuff, but there were definitely one or two cases where you could tell. I think they took the meeting with no interest in investing in Curie whatsoever, but they just wanted to like bring their crypto guy to argue with me. And so that definitely, I mean, I took 200 LP meetings. So this was, you know,
where the fuck? We should have filmed that.
Well, I didn't know it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I show up and then there's like the guy who doesn't say anything when I do the biotech pitch. And then at the end, it's like,
they stick the attack dog on you.
Yeah. And I'm sure all of them have now lost money by not listening. But yeah, I don't, you know, it was, I personally think it was a good thing because there was a reason to talk to LPs and then, you know, even for the ones that didn't understand biotech particularly well, now we could explain it and get them interested. So overall net positive, but I had to stop at some point because now I have a real job.
Yeah.
I have to like do this.
Cool. Well, Zach, thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
It was fun. We'll do another markets, AI, crypto.
A tech one,
not okay. A biotech one. Now you have your definitive, you have all your crypto ones. Now you have your definitive biotech healthcare.
I still love doing the tech stuff.
Yeah.
It's like my, you know,
we'll do that in a few weeks. We could make it quarterly or something. Just you randomly opining for.
Yeah.
You're not going to go away.
No. It's nice not to have a horse in the race now.
That's right. You don't have a horse in the race. You don't have any branding. When I came to you and said, hey, I'm going to do this, you're like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Works for me.
Yeah. Good quote, by the way, to the reporter.
Which one?
I think he reached out to you and he's like, hey, I'm doing an article on the podcast and I like your quote. And
who's
you're like,
Logan?
You're like, which one's Logan? I only remember the handsome guy, Rashad.
I spent like 5 minutes writing that.
Yeah.
It wasn't like off the cuff.
It was good. I got a good laugh.
Prep.
All right. Well, thanks for this.
All right, man.
See ya.
So that'll do it for the 54th episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Thank you to Zach Weinberg for coming on. Thank you to Rashad and Justin for their efforts with the episode. And thank you everyone for listening. Fun episode, and look forward to seeing everyone here back next week on the 55th episode of Logan Bartlett Show. Hope everyone has a nice weekend.